Bi Plus, podcasting for the Bi Plus universe. I'm Elizabeth Meacham, here with my co-host Mick Collins. Today we welcome Zoe Whittall to discuss her upcoming book, The Spectacular. Could you tell us a bit about yourself?
Sure. So I am originally from a small town in Quebec, which is on the East Coast in Canada. Well, you know, middle East Coast. And I have been in Toronto for about 20 years now. And I'm a novelist and a TV writer. The Spectacular is my fourth novel. My last novel was called The Best Kind of People. That's currently being developed into a limited series by Sarah Polley, which should be happening in the next year or two. And I had two previous books. The book before, Holding Still for as Long as Possible, won a Lando Literary Award for trans fiction in 2011. And Bottle Rocket Hearts was my debut novel. Mostly my novels, and I'm a poet too, and I've published a few books of poetry. Mostly my novels have a lot of queer characters and are set in sort of queer milieus. And The Spectacular is about three women, and one of whom is a queer femme, but she doesn't really come out until she's in her late 30s. And that's sort of the latter half of the book. But the book is about a whole lot of things, but it's a lot about sexual autonomy and reproductive freedoms and motherhood. The book was sort of inspired by the fact that from like the age of 30 to 40, I woke up every day asking myself, should I have kids? Should I not have kids? Like not quite figuring out an answer. And I think because, you know, for queer people, there's just so much more planning that has to go into that decision. And I just, the circumstances of my life never quite, you know, supported the decision. Like my ex-girlfriend was, didn't want kids. And so when I was 37, we broke up, and then I ended up falling in love with a guy who already had two kids, and then became a sort of step-parent figure for a while. And so I kind of wanted to look at the idea of like, should I, shouldn't I, through the lens of three different characters in three different time periods. And so when we first meet Missy, our main narrator, it's the 90s, and she's a cellist in an indie rock band, and she's about to go on tour, and she tries to get her tubes tied before she goes. And, you know, if you're a man, you can get a vasectomy at will. If you're a woman, you cannot. And I based her story, that part of the story, on the fact that my ex-sister-in-law tried to get the procedure done when she was about 38. And she's known since birth that she didn't want to be a parent, and no doctor would do it. They all said she would regret it, even though she was already 38. And so I sort of put this conundrum into the character of Missy, who tries to do this when she's in her early 20s. And she has a complicated relationship with her mother, who, Carola, who's the second narrator, who has a kid when she's in her early 20s, has Missy when she's in her early 20s, when she's, her and her husband start a commune in Vermont in the 70s, and they raise her there. And it's a bit of a shit show, as like a lot of collective living situations can be. And she ends up leaving the family at 13, when Missy's 13, to go and live at, like, essentially, I don't know if you've ever heard of Kripalu. It's like a yoga center in Massachusetts. So it's sort of a fictionalized version of Kripalu. And the book sort of starts when Missy's in her early 20s, and she hasn't seen her mom for 10 years, and her band gets really famous for a summer, and they tour, and it becomes a bit of a debaucherous, rollicking time for her in her life. And it kind of goes from there. In the second half of the book, we meet Missy again when she's almost 40, and she gets divorced and decides she wants to have a kid on her own. And she realizes she sort of surrounded herself by queer people her whole life. And she had one really significant relationship with someone in her 20s that was queer in her mind. And then she doesn't really ever come out or realize that she's bi until her late 30s at this moment where she meets someone and falls in love. And so the latter half of the book is sort of a love story between Missy and a trans man named Andy. And it's sort of about their doomed love and about, you know, whether or not she is going to make the decision to have a kid on her own or stay with Andy. Yeah, there's all sorts of things in the book. I'm like kind of skimming over what happens, but that's sort of the main meat of it.
Well, I mean, it sounds like there's definitely a plenty to dig into for that one. And sounds like there's probably some challenges just, you know, trying to go through it all. What were some of the challenges writing about just gender and sexual fluidity?
So some of the challenges for me as the author was like, I mean, one of the questions that I started out with when I was thinking about the book was like, what if I hadn't realized I was queer when I was 18? You know, like, I think that if a woman hadn't come up to me and been like, hey, I like you, I probably would never have noticed. Like, I just feel like I just would have kept being mostly in relationships with men. But I had the experience of coming out where I, you know, I had lots of boyfriends and then I slept with a woman and I was like, well, maybe that's not my thing either. Like, I was just sort of like confused by what was true. And I think that's a lot of people who identify as bi have that sort of similar feeling of not knowing where to belong when you first try to figure yourself out. Okay. And then I wondered like, oh, I could have easily just not realized for a really long time. And particularly like I identify as a femme, and one of the first words that really made sense to me when I was young was femme, and to the words queer and femme. And, you know, I've mostly in my life dated people on the masculine spectrum, but, you know, have recently begun to date other femmes. But I wondered like, what would have happened? What could that have been like for me to not realize like who I was until later? And so that's the kind of question that I gave Missy. And there were some particular like, things about that were challenging creatively, like in terms of setting up the form of the story, because I'm cis and a femme, but I wanted to have this primary relationship with her and a trans man. Like I have, I've dated a lot of trans men. I have a lot of trans men in my life, and so I had quite a few friends read the manuscript to make sure that I was, that things felt authentic to them.
Yeah.
But also complicated enough. Like I feel like there's some downsides to doing the authenticity read things, but I wanted to be like, you know, capture a moment. There was a funny moment where Missy and Andy are having a conversation. He has three kids. When they start dating, he has three kids, two kids and a stepkid. And the older teenager is identifies as non-binary, and they think that their dad is like square for being like binary trans and like makes fun of him. And so I have this kind of playful, jokey exchange between Missy and Andy about like realizing that. And I thought it was a really like authentic conversation about how it feels to be like, I'm 45, how it feels to have like, you know, I've been out since 1994. You know, I've seen cycles of language and cycles of like politics and things that repeat themselves, and like the way that you can be so like earnestly convinced that you're right about absolutely everything when you're 18, you know, like I've been that person. And so I thought it was a really funny, playful exchange. And then like my publisher had a sensitivity reader look at the book, and they flagged that section as potentially problematic towards non-binary folks. And I was just like, you know, this is like a literal joke that came from my life where I am surrounded by my whole social world, my family, my friends were all queer and trans and non-binary. And so it's like, it's funny to like see those generational issues come up and how they might impact story, which I think is like a bit creatively dangerous. But those are some of the things that came up, like wanting to make sure that I felt free to describe this really tumultuous relationship, but also make sure that I wasn't, I don't know, contributing to any negative representation.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's got to be difficult. Having to write around things like that, it's going to be hard.
On the one hand, I want to be like, oh, language evolves and it's fine, we should roll with it. And then, you know, there's so many sides to that, especially when you're an artist. It's like,
yeah. And we don't know what the language is necessarily because it keeps changing, you know. So it's so changing all the time, and you learn the new stuff and the new stuff is old. And but, you know, it's so hard to keep up. The older I get, the harder it is to keep up, but it's so, and everything is going so fast.
And I think the other side of that is that I experience some frustration when younger people don't know queer history.
Yeah, like I, yeah.
Like, you know, part of the sensitivity readers issue, I've had a couple of things that they were mentioning, but like they pointed out that using the word dyke was offensive in some circles, and I was like.
But yeah, okay.
Like, you know, clearly, there's some history and reason why we use that word and why I use that word. And it was really insightful in terms of like, and interesting to me that publishers put money into doing this new practice, and like, they're really trying to protect themselves. Like they're trying to protect their investment. And it's not really about like the integrity of the work or the accuracy of the work. It's about capitalism.
I wonder if you were a lesbian, if that would be an issue. Like, is it okay?
Well, I do identify as a dyke. Like I use that word. My really good friend calls me a cultural lesbian. Because it's like or secular, sorry, that's the joke.
Secular dyke.
I'm a secular dyke. Like I have a dyke. I did mostly like I have a cis guy that I'm dating now, but like, you know, I've mostly been in the lesbian community for 20 years. So it's like it's part
that's
of me.
Funny. Yeah.
Identity is so
changed. But it's still, it's like that bi girls can be dykes, you know, and we do use that word, and it's, you know, we get called that word too.
If you watch Glee with your parents, like you don't get to police my language, you know, like,
people have
thrown beer cans at my head calling me a dyke, like I can use it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Still, exactly.
There was this whole, when Tumblr was a big thing, whole argument about, can bi women use the word dyke? Don't tell me what I can use first off, you know?
Yeah.
And no, you don't get to do that. So, and that kind of bothers me too. It's like the sensitivity reader policing, it's offensive to non-binary people. Is it offensive to all non-binary people in this context? And taking it out of context.
It also assumes a monolithic.
Yeah.
Like, that everybody thinks the same. There's like automatically a lack of complexity in the argument.
Yeah, it seems like you'd have to have more than one sensitivity reader.
These are good because you can, sometimes it's good to have these just so you're continuing on a conversation it's a conversation that's going to go on for a long time. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand too, you kind of have to keep in mind having these discussions, you know, results may vary from person to person. And there's experiences and things like that. I'm all for reclaiming these words. Mm-hmm. Like queer can clear a room quick, but I will use it in a heartbeat because if someone's going to try and use it against me, I'm using that bitch.
Oh yeah.
The word evolved to like really name something that was unnameable in the mm-hmm. community. Like, and also like provided for me, like I remember back in like Queer Nation days.
Yeah.
It was like solidarity between gay men and lesbians. It was like, you know, inclusive of bisexuals, like pansexual. Mm-hmm. It was like a really unifying word. And it was also a really political word that it was like more political than gay or lesbian. It meant something about like being intersectional and anti-oppressive in a way that you can't really, you know, that doesn't happen with other words.
Yeah, it's important to reclaim those words. How do you write, you know, with these words and all this stuff, can you actually write a character that's being offensive? You know, like.
I mean, you know, I go as the writer, I usually start every story with character, and the character kind of moves the plot, you know. Or I'm also very into like, you know, my choices around form and style also inform the character and inform the plot. But can I write some? I mean, I think that, you know, some of my favorite works as a reader are about like lonely weird old men, or like, mm-hmm. you know, I think that there's really no, I think that there's a real, there's a way that readers are kind of have been encouraged recently to be like really moralistic about like, and ask questions about fictional characters, about whether or not they're good or bad people, and to, or do you relate to them? Do you like them? Are characters likable? Like, I think that none of those questions have any worth in terms of, determining art. Like art is, yeah. art is supposed to move you, is supposed to allow you to experience something negative, positive, what have you. And I think that we've been trained, I think, by like entertainment, which is supposed to just, you know, thrill you or keep you occupied or whatever. Yeah. I think that like you can't look at art the same way that you look at a scholarly essay or mm-hmm. a movie. I think you have to be willing to go where the ickiness is, you know, like yeah. some of the greatest characters come from shame, like some of the best writing comes from like the places that we're ashamed of and the things we're afraid to think about or contemplate, and that's where you get some of the richness in character and in situations and in people you really want to follow into their world momentarily. So I feel like I mean, I'm not, as a writer, like I'm not particularly drawn to be like, oh, I'm gonna choose this character who's offensive in this way and then explore that. That's kind of like not how it works in terms of the construction of story. But I do think that characters have to be real in a way, and to be real, you have to be multifaceted and flawed, and you can't ignore the negative.
So, you know, that's interesting. You brought up entertainment. I don't know how it is in Canada, but here, you know, everything is, we've got this, and it's a voluntary association. This is not a government thing. If people don't know that, the MPAA, the Motion Picture Association of America, it's a bunch of, you know, white people sitting on a board somewhere, conservative people censoring movies, and they censor out any sexuality.
Especially queerness. Yeah.
Yes, especially queerness. Violence is okay, because, you know.
Yeah.
And then same thing with the TV rating system, the censorship thing there. And now it feels like it's kind of put this expectation on all art that we can't talk about sex. Do you think that affects how people write books?
I think that, I don't write young adult fiction, but I do think that young adult authors are under a particular amount of pressure in that sense. And I do think that queers are always, and marginalized people in general, are always going to be like the first on the chopping block whenever those kinds of things arise. And I think sometimes like the impulse to give a trigger warning or like, warn about content or think yeah. about content, I think that sometimes it can come from a place of like truly thinking that that can be a disability access issue, like mm-hmm. wanting to make sure that no one is hurt or harmed.
Yeah.
I do like just fundamentally believe that like you cannot predict what a trigger would be, and you cannot, art cannot cause harm in that kind of sense, the same way that like propaganda or Fox News or Marvel movies can. And I think that like once you start legislating censorship or like ratings, like it's only going to be bad for art, and it's only going to be bad in particular for marginalized creators.
Yeah.
I think it's a shame that like a lot of the censorship talk comes from like the leftist marginalized world.
But
I think it's also kind of like makes sense in terms of like how things evolve. But I do think that I do see just on social media, like writers starting to reckon with that. Because, you know, there's always there's so many places at the table for everyone to tell their stories, to make their work. And, you know, it's just the more opportunities we can give other queer and trans writers and artists to, you know, to expand what they're trying to do, to experiment, to make mistakes, like all of that is just, is good. And I think like the more we play like the role of public scolds to each other, there's that, there's a lot in an Ariana Raines poem about how everybody has turned into a public scold. And I do think that that's true. And I feel like I'm guilty of that myself, but I do think if there's been a, like a bit of a hush factor on art and like what we can create and what we can't. And
I you see a lot of that, and especially like looking at the trigger warnings, you know, some of them make perfect sense and I'm glad to see them, but some of them I think we tend to, because we naturally want to shy away from things that are uncomfortable. And if maybe, you know, art is, has many functions, and you know, it always been kind of my mind that art, one of its functions is sometimes make us uncomfortable, because we need to be in order to keep having conversations and see things. And so I think maybe, I don't know if that's something you see, but you know, part of that is taking a perfectly good function like a trigger warning and that impulse to hide the uncomfortable kind of kicks in whether we realize it or not.
How Mick, you've written young adult novels. Were you kind of that experience where you felt like you were censored a lot?
I don't know if I was, there was a lot of self-censoring at the beginning, and it was more of dealing, because I deal with religion in it, and I was trying to self-censor because I want, not tiptoe, but be careful with it, because that wasn't the focus of the book, and I wanted to make sure it wasn't the focus of the book. And I think most of the, if I've gotten any criticism from it, it, which hasn't been much, thankfully, but it was from that more than anything. But I also self-published too. So I just, you know, I'm gonna write what I'm gonna write, and no one really had, for better or for worse, no one really had any extra input in it.
Do you have any experience with that, with self-publishing, Zoe?
No, I don't, except, I mean, when I was a teenager, I did write zines. That's my my era. So I like, my heart still belongs to the DIY world. But I'm really happy to, I'm really happy with my publishers now, and have had a pretty great journey in that sense.
Cool. We discussed a little about entertainment. What are the differences between writing for TV and writing novels or poetry, and what things are easier and more difficult?
It's a good question. So TV is a very collaborative medium, and that's the main difference. I think it's the, it's that, there are several main differences. One is that, like, you know, when you're watching a TV show and it says written by blah, 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 it's actually written by like 20 people in a room. And that person, you know, is able to take the script and do the actual writing. But like the concepts, the story, the structure, all of it is collaborative. And all of it is also like, in terms of what actually gets on camera, is mostly up to the showrunners. So it's all about like their tone, their voice. But it's also a medium where you have, you know, just constant ideas. You know, you're in a room with 20 people and you just, you're shooting out ideas and the best one wins. And then the next day an executive reads it and says like, actually, I don't want that. And then you have to go back and change it. Like, whereas when you're writing prose, you're like in a room by yourself for 4 years, you know? And you have the final say. You know, your editor, the editor-writer relationship is like a beautiful thing, and I feel really lucky to have attentive editors who can like gently steer me away from problems. But ultimately it is your work, and you can be more attached to it in that sense. Like, and then the other major difference, I think, is financial. You know, it's really, I got into TV in a way initially to make money, and then was delighted to figure out how much I actually loved it creatively. And I mean, it makes sense because I love watching television and I appreciate the form, but I wasn't sure, you know, it's such a, there's a bit, there's so much secrecy around, unless you work in TV, there's like a lot of things that people don't know about how it's produced and made. And it is a lot different than I thought it would be, but like just on the page, I think that, writing for TV has helped my prose in terms of, plotting and action and, you know, having, trying to keep people's eyeballs on the screen. It's a real game. And I think that, you know, I started out as a poet and my works were initially more experimental, more style-based, more language-based. And like TV has helped me like not be so afraid of plot.
It definitely sounds like, you know, it's same yet different in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So which do you prefer?
I mean, I have not yet, I'm still pretty new in TV. I've not yet had the opportunity to make my own show. And so that's my goal. My goal is to produce my own show. And the way it works is that like you can have a lot, I've had several shows in development. I've sold a couple, like the amount of, especially in Canada, there's hundreds of shows in development at any one point. And then like a network will be like, okay, these two we're gonna go. And the rest are in the garbage, you know, like,
yeah,
so competitive. It's so hard to get a show on the air. Even once you film the pilot, it's really, really hard to get more episodes.
Yeah.
So I don't really think I can answer that until I know what that experience is like, but really like, I sometimes joke that if, you know, if I didn't have to worry about money, I would be writing poetic novels in fragments, you know, like, yeah. Very literary work. So in some ways I kind of know that books are my first love in that sense.
So can you tell us any of the shows you've been on?
Yes, I started out on Degrassi. I don't know if you know Degrassi. It's like a teen
show. Yeah,
it's
a long time ago. Yeah.
Yeah. And they had a reboot. So this was like,
oh wow, okay.
Yeah.
I didn't know about the reboot.
And then I was on Schitt's Creek first season. And I don't know if you guys have watched that, but it got and then Baroness Von Sketch Show is one of the best experiences.
I love that show.
Funny, we're so glad you've heard
I
of
haven't
it.
Seen that one yet.
It's a woman-based sketch show. It's on what is that channel that the Portlandia was on?
IFC.
Yes, IFC. Yeah, it's on IFC. Nice. Oh yeah, I could have just asked you.
Very funny, very clear. Yeah, so I had like a ball writing on that show.
Yeah, what was it like working with all those people? How many writers were on that show?
You know, it's a lot. But what they did was they had the core cast and two main staff writers, and then they would have writers come in for 2-3 weeks and they'd rotate, kind of like how the kids in the hall used to do it. And so I would go in for like 2 or 3 weeks a season and just try to like bang out as many sketches as I could.
Oh wow.
So much nice. Fun. Yeah, it was the nicest room. Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. And it was there's the gal that's on it. She was in Man/Woman. It was a British sketch show.
Yes, Meredith McNeil.
She doesn't age. What is her deal? Like she's like ageless. I watched the other thing 10 years ago. How do you look the same? She still looks like she's in her 20s. I'm like, what? Anyway. Okay.
One of the writers on that show that I wrote with, Mae Martin, has a new show on Netflix called Feel Good, and it's got a bi protagonist. Ooh. And I would really encourage you to check it out. It's so funny, so smart.
Is it on now?
Okay. It's on Netflix now, yeah. Okay. There's two seasons. It's called Feel Good.
And Canadian Netflix is the same as American Netflix?
Because it's a bit different, but it's like, yeah, I think it was filmed in the UK. It's a UK production.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure it's not, yeah, it's on Netflix, all the Netflixes.
I'm going to look this up right after we get done with this. Bi-protagonist, I'm there. Okay, cool.
Circling back to the spectacular, someone were to pick it up, what other works, if you know, reader picked it, what other works would they find familiar with spectacular? What might surprise them?
Of my own works?
Yeah.
You know, It's similar to my last book in that there are multiple narrators, but it's also similar to my first two books in that it's very, like there's some kind of, the voice of one of the characters is very like first person monologue, funny, audacious, scandalous a little bit. There's quite a lot of like romance and sex and intrigue and talk of love in that way. My last book had a bit of a like mystery to it. So there isn't really a mystery, but there is a lot of, you know, there's a lot of what's going to happen between Missy and her mom who were estranged. And so I think it will pull you in that sense, hopefully.
Cool. Yeah.
Very cool.
So you have four novels out, you said? This is your fourth? This is
my fourth. I did also write a novella. So technically it's fifth work of fiction. And, you know, I had three poetry books before that. So it's actually, this year is the 20th anniversary of my first poetry book.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
I got to ask both of you, because Mick writes too, do you guys ever recycle your characters? Like, maybe not by name, but personalities? Like, not on purpose even, but just have like a favorite type of person that you stick in your books that you just unaware of maybe, or aware of consciously or unconsciously?
Sometimes I repeat imagery. And I like, an editor caught it once. She was like, you had this joke or this line in your last book, and I didn't remember.
It's a funny joke. Yeah.
I really like neurotic people. I really like anxious people because I am one. And so I like a character who's like ruminates and is obsessive. And so that kind of personality repeats, I think.
How about you, man?
I think in my novels, I try really hard to have different people, but I write a lot of short stories, and I've noticed a tendency to try and, or not try, but it just kind of comes out, I will recycle certain type of personalities in my short stories, because like I have, like in my head, I have stock characters I use for my short stories, even though they're all supposed to be different. Yeah, I have been tempted to bring back, like, sneak some cameos in here and there, but I haven't pulled the trigger on that yet. But
that actually would be,
yeah, I guess growing up watching sketch comedies or stock players in my head.
Yeah.
At all.
Yeah. We all grew up on sketch comedy between SCTV and Kids in the Hall and Saturday Night Live.
Oh, Kids, yeah. Kids in the Hall doing a reboot. They're filming it right now.
Nice.
Kids in the Hall.
Yeah.
You got all the good info. Yeah, all the good info.
Yeah, I was lucky to work on a show with Bruce McCullough a couple of years ago that didn't end up going, but now I have all the inside info.
Nice.
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. And they make fun of our short attention spans. It's all their fault. Whatever. Yeah. Cool. Is there anything else? First off, when and where can everybody buy your book?
So the launch date in America is September 14th. It's put out by Ballantine Books, and you can order it anywhere in the States.
Cool. Remember your local booksellers, people.
Yeah, local indies would be great.
Yes, yep. They'll order it for you. And of course, Amazon and Barnes & Noble and things like that. And September 14th, wow. Anything else that we missed? Do you have any promotional things you'd like to mention that are coming up, or you're gonna be somewhere or on something? Or
I can't think of anything that would work that I can say, but I would really appreciate any pre-orders. Pre-orders really help.
Pre-orders are awesome. Yeah. Well, Zoe, thank you for joining us today. Yeah, very nice to meet you, and very nice talking with you. This has been fun.
It's super fun.
Yeah. And yeah, we got to do it again sometime.
Yes.
Thanks also to my wonderful co-host, the amazing Mick Collins. And the book is The Spectacular. It's out on September 4th through your favorite bookseller or pre-orders. Remember the pre-orders? Pre-orders, yes. I'm Elizabeth Meacham. Remember, there's a whole Bi+ universe out there ready to embrace you. Reach out and find your community. Thank you.